Hey there, you're listening to KWMR, Point Reyes Station. I'm the space vato, Jaime Crespo. I'm from a moon right around near Saturn, and whenever I'm on your planet, I listen to KWMR, West Marin Community Radio.
Media support for KWMR is provided by the Point Reyes Light, family-owned since 1948. More information online at ptreyeslight.com.
KWMR is supported by our listener members and by the Maritime Radio Historical Society. Online at radiomarine.org. That's radio, MARINE.ORG.
Hello, I'm Brent Bambury. This is Day 6.
Grieving Ottawa family wants answers after a young man plunged 12 floors to his death following a police raid.
At least 8 heavily armed police crashed the door and set off a flashbang grenade.
That's all they had to do. Come to the door and knock.
The problems with no-knock warrants and how they're used in Canada. That's coming up on Day 6 today when polling gets it wrong.
You have to look on social media.
Could AI technology fill the gap when pollsters fail? Boy bands and big business.
7 individuals now have become incredibly precious.
The real value investors see in the BTS offering and icing the iceberg.
So delicious, it's so juicy.
Why iceberg lettuce still belongs on your plate. All today on Day 6, the salad menu on the Titanic edition. We're back after the news. I'm Brent Bambury. Welcome back to Day 6.
I mean, if it was the police at the door and they just said we're the police, me or Brianna didn't have a reason at all not to open the door and see what they wanted.
That is Kenneth Walker, Breonna Taylor's boyfriend. He's talking about the night Louisville police raided her apartment with a no-knock warrant and ended up shooting and killing Breonna Taylor. Since then, the city of Louisville has banned the use of no-knock warrants, but they're still common in plenty of other places, including Canada.
That's all they have to do. Come to the door and knock. But they came like terrorists.
10 days ago, Ottawa police raided an apartment with a no-knock warrant. Anthony Oust, the 23-year-old man who was the subject of their warrant, jumped from a 12th-floor window and died. Oust's 12 and 13-year-old siblings were in the apartment at the time, as was his 94-year-old grandmother, his girlfriend, and his stepfather. Oust was living with his family in the Ottawa suburb of Gloucester as he was out on bail and awaiting his trial for possession of drugs and a gun. He was wearing an ankle monitor at the time of his death. Police won't say whether they found drugs in the apartment during the raid. Judy Trin is a reporter with the CBC's Fifth Estate. She's been investigating Oust's death and the use of no-knock warrants. Judy, good morning. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Brent. Thanks for inviting me.
Judy, there is a video of this raid. Can you describe the scene for us as police arrived at the Oust apartment?
The video comes from a camera that is mounted inside a home. And what we see is shortly before 9 a.m. Last Wednesday, October 7th, we see the door being forced open with a battering ram. Then we see heavily armed officers throw a flashbang grenade. It's a distractionary device that sets off smoke and flashes of light. And it's loud. It sounds like a gunshot. And then we see at least 8 SWAT officers, and they are holding semi-automatic rifles, and they barge in.
We don't see Anthony Oust exit the apartment, but he did fall 12 stories to his death as a result of this raid. Do we know if he fell or if he jumped? Do we know whether he fell after being startled? What do we know about that?
That is what Ontario's police watchdog, the SIU, is investigating right now. But I can tell you that his parents believe he jumped. They believe that he was startled and that he was so frightened of police that he tried to get away. And we know that he was in a small bedroom with a bunk bed pushed up against the window. Mm-hmm. And he shared that room with his 12-year-old brother. So Anthony Yao's 12-year-old brother was in the room when he fell.
And police were executing this no-knock search warrant, which is described as a dynamic entry. Do we know what the police were searching for?
I haven't seen the search warrant. I've tried to obtain it. It is currently sealed. But I spoke to Anthony Yao's mother, Nora Oust, and she told me that she saw the warrant. And the warrant was for a search for cocaine and a gun.
And that is generally why these warrants are issued, because they're expecting to find a large amount of drugs or weapons?
You know, you use the word large. I don't know what the critical threshold for that is, and I think that is one of the questions we have to probe deeper on. But what I can tell you is that I've spoken to defense lawyers, and I've also spoken to an ex-SWAT officer with the Ottawa Police. And what they tell me is that these warrants are usually carried out when there is a concern that there could be drugs that will be flushed down the toilet, any type of evidence that will be destroyed, or perhaps the presence of a gun, which would make it dangerous for officers to knock first. And that's why they get the SWAT team involved.
But who's providing these officers with the evidence that they have to get the warrant? Who's telling them that there may be guns or drugs in this apartment?
That's a really interesting question, Brent, because these are legal raids and these warrants have to be signed by judges or justice of the peace. So they have to have some type of evidence attached to them, information attached to them that justifies their use. I spoke to Mark Ertl, a local defense lawyer here, and what he tells me is that the information on these warrants usually comes from informants who are paid, who may have criminal records, or who are also willing to trade charges or lesser offenses in order to bring out information to someone else. So the question is, how reliable is this information that's being put on the warrant to justify these no-knock raids or dynamic entries, as they're called in Canada?
There are also other people in the apartment who must be presumed innocent, including Anthony's 94-year-old grandmother, as you mentioned, his 12-year-old brother, his 13-year-old sister. Is there any consideration given when the warrant's granted to the other people who may also be in the domicile?
So when I spoke to the ex-Ottawa SWAT officer, what he told me is that a risk assessment is always done, that they need to know who is inside, or they want to know the best information in terms of who could be in there, because police want to minimize harm, minimize injuries. They don't want to be responsible for a death in a situation like this. So they're supposed to have that research. But it goes back to the information. How good is the information? Was it properly vetted?
In 2010, Judy, the Supreme Court of Canada ruled that no-knock warrants should only be used in urgent cases. What have you found has happened instead?
What I found is that they are being frequently used in any type of search warrant. What I don't know is, what is the critical threshold? Like, does it have to be a certain amount of drugs? So we don't have those answers. But what I can tell you is that the ex-SWAT officer I spoke to said these raids happen hundreds of times a year in Ontario. So there is a lot of collateral damage. Knowing that there was the possibility of all these individuals in the home, why did they choose to go in and raid the home? Why were tactical officers used? Why were flashbangs used?
In February, Judy, an Ontario Superior Court judge criticized Ottawa police over their use of no-knock search warrants. What did the judge say?
Justice Sally Gomery wrote that she was very concerned about the frequency of these no-knock raids. She wanted police to commit to only using them in vital cases. And she said that the amount of times that these raids were being used resulted in a casual disregard for charter rights. So people's constitutional rights were being trampled in these raids.
That was in February. Is there any evidence that Ottawa police have curbed their use of these warrants since then?
I've spoken to several lawyers on this, and they say no. One thing to note, too, is that you mentioned Breonna Taylor. And Breonna Taylor's case leads to a banning of no knocks in her home state. Mm-hmm. Mark Erdl, the lawyer who successfully argued in front of Justice Sally Gomery, says that there's no such movement in Canada to ban our equivalent of no knocks. And he says, in many ways, dynamic entries are more risky and dangerous than the US version of no knocks. Because if you look at the video in Breonna Taylor's case, the officers didn't use flashbangs. In Ottawa, dynamic entries are usually the norm when SWAT is called in to deal with these search warrants.
Judy Trin, thank you very much for being with us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Judy Trin is a reporter with the CBC's Fifth Estate. Here's another story we're keeping an eye on this weekend.
I won't stop. I've been fishing since 1998. I've been in court since 1999 about these fishing rights.
Indigenous fishermen in Nova Scotia say they will not back down in the face of violence. On Tuesday night, about 200 non-Indigenous fishermen and their supporters raided two lobster pounds where some Indigenous fishermen were holding the catch. Some in the crowd threw rocks. Two vans belonging to Mi'kmaq fishermen were destroyed. Hundreds of dead lobster were scattered on the street. Jason Marr, a Mi'kmaq fisherman, had to barricade himself inside one of the facilities.
They said they were coming in to take the lobster, and we need to let them in to take the lobster out. They smashed out all the windows and hit a couple of us there with rocks and said they were coming in to burn us out by midnight.
Marr says he wasn't able to leave the building until 3 in the morning, and he says RCMP officers on the scene didn't do enough to stop what was happening.
Not one RCMP even tried to stop them. The RCMP even helped them carry the lobster out.
RCMP have defended their actions, saying they were there primarily to help keep the peace. Indigenous leaders have condemned the attacks as racist hate crimes. Last month, the Sebega Negati Band launched their Indigenous fishery at a time when the commercial fishing season is closed. The Supreme Court has ruled that Indigenous people have a right to earn a moderate livelihood from fishing. Non-Indigenous fishermen's groups say they are concerned about conservation. No charges have been laid in relation to the raids. Still lots to come here on Day 6, including how the progressive idealism of the West Wing holds up in the age of Trump. A look at the West Wing reunion. Welcome back to Day 6.
Oh, I love to see the line out here. As much as I hate to stand in it, I love to see everybody coming out, participating.
An optimist in line at the polls this week as early in-person voting began in most U.S. states. Across the country, voters are turning out early in record-breaking numbers, and that has created long waits in places like Georgia.
Voting rights advocates say it's not okay to make people wait like this.
There have been problems with poll pads, ballot access cards, and just taking a lot longer to process through line.
This year's presidential election is taking place against an unprecedented backdrop, a global pandemic, months-long protests for racial justice, widespread misinformation, and a president who is sowing unfounded fears of electoral fraud and refusing to commit to honoring the results. For more than 30 years, the Carter Center has monitored elections all over the world. This year, for the very first time, it's gotten involved in a U.S. election. Avery Davis Roberts is the Associate Director of the Carter Center's Democracy Program. Avery, good morning. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Brent. It's great to be here.
It's the first time ever that the Carter Center has become involved in a U.S. election. Why now?
So the Carter Center has observed over 100 elections in 39 countries around the world. And when we're choosing where we are going to observe, we often think of sort of a number of criteria for making those selections. So we will often work in countries that are sort of at a moment of transition, maybe countries that are taking steps forward, or maybe where we see a little bit of democratic backsliding. We often work in countries that are suffering from extreme political polarization, or countries where there has been a lot of racial or ethnic tension that is sort of simmering, but could be sparked into something more dangerous right around an election. For the last, you know, many years, the United States didn't really meet those criteria. Mm-hmm. But I think when we have looked back over the course of the last 5 years, 10 years even, we see that many of those characteristics are sort of emerging or have emerged in the United States. And so it felt like it was a time for the Carter Center to do what we could to contribute to a good, strong democratic process this year.
Avery, you have had experience monitoring elections in the many countries that the Carter Center has visited. Did you ever think that you would be applying those skills, your skills, to an election in the U.S.?
You know, I think many of us that work at the Carter Center have felt that, you know, there was work to be done here even before these elections. You know, no election is perfect. You know, no matter what country you're in, no matter what election we're thinking about, there's always the need for some sort of observation or transparency mechanisms to help that process along and help the public understand what's happening within that election process.
Well, let's look at some of the issues here, because for years now, we know that there has been foreign intervention, foreign interference in American democracy. But when it comes to the physical ballot box where people are voting today, do you believe that U.S. citizens will be able to cast their votes freely and without interference when they show up to vote?
I certainly hope so. Mm-hmm. There have been attempts in the past to infiltrate the U.S. election systems, particularly voter registration systems around 2016, but we know that it didn't really actually impact the election process. But it does have a corrosive, these narratives around interference do have a corrosive effect on people's confidence in the election process.
I'm really asking about the basic safety of people who try to exercise their right to vote, because, as you know, President Trump has told his supporters to go out to the polls and watch, and they're training what they call an army of poll watchers. So they're applying this militaristic term to what they want to do. Does that worry you?
It's definitely a worry. The calls for people to sort of be aggressive, I think some people have termed it sort of aggressive monitors, or this use of words like this army of poll watchers, even if people don't necessarily turn out in that capacity, even if they don't respond to that call, the fact that that idea is out there can act to sort of suppress votes, and that people might feel less comfortable turning out. Going out and voting anyway is the best antidote to the toxic narrative around voter sort of intimidation around this sort of aggressive poll watching that is currently circulating and swirling around this election.
But there is another deterrent that we can perceive, and that's these delays, the long lines, the long waits, in some cases 8 hours or more. And voter enthusiasm and pandemic concerns might have been part of the reason why people are turning up en masse to vote early. But some people caution that this may be a form of voter suppression that's going on. Are there enough polls? Are there enough ballot boxes available in the populous urban areas? Because what we're seeing in Ohio is a suggestion that rural areas are well served by the early polls facilities, and the urban areas, which are generally more concentrated population, often a more Democratic-leaning population, they're less well served. Could that be a manufactured problem?
You know, I mean, I think that's definitely a concern when the infrastructure for voting, number of polling locations or number of drop boxes doesn't seem to really correlate to the size of the voting population mm-hmm. in a given jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't speak for Ohio. I have been following Georgia a lot more closely. I can say Fulton County, one of the most populous counties in Georgia, has set up 30 early voting locations. But still, we see these long lines. I think one of the challenges that election administrators are having this year is trying to anticipate voter behavior in a very uncertain circumstance right. that is the pandemic.
Right.
But I do think that your point about whether or not a lack of voting infrastructure could have a suppressive effect is a good question. And I think we just don't know enough to know really exactly what's going on.
The Carter Center has launched a public information campaign, and misinformation has been a big issue in the lead up to this election and also to the 2016 election. What worries you most about this issue of misinformation in 2020?
You know, I think that there, misinformation can impact the process in a couple of ways. First of all, at the sort of most basic level, obviously you want people to really have factual information about how to vote, where to vote, all of the sort of the mechanics of the process. Mm-hmm. But I think misinformation also has this sort of more corrosive, larger effect in that it really serves to undermine public trust in the election process, undermine public trust in the democratic process, which is really concerning and has long-term effects and is something that I think we'll need to be thinking about way beyond this immediate election period.
Avery, you're volunteering as a poll worker on election day, November 3rd. How anxious are you about what might happen?
I think the thing that gives me the most anxiety about being a poll worker on November 3rd is just the number of people that might turn up to vote.
Right.
I've only been a poll worker one other time in a primary uh-huh. election, and so I think we had a grand total of 119 people come in that day, and so
you'll get more.
I felt like I could manage that.
Right.
I think we're estimating at my polling precinct where I'll be working maybe 1,500 people, which will be a considerably different day for me. So I'm most anxious about just making sure that they don't have to wait in line and that they don't feel, you know, concerned about being inside during the pandemic.
Right. Avery Davis Roberts, thank you very much for being with us and good luck on November 3rd.
Thank you so much, Brent. It's been great.
Avery Davis Roberts is the Associate Director of the Carter Center's Democracy Program.
So here we are again at the end of a week asking, in the polling, what changed this week?
New national polling numbers came out this week ahead of the U.S. presidential election, and they're not looking great for Donald Trump.
The Arizona, we lead it right now for Joe Biden. That's trouble for the president, losing in places he won before. The tide in the states, not just the national polls, is Biden's way right now.
But then we've been here before.
The last national polling before the race is decided. A national poll from Monmouth University gives Clinton a 6-point lead, 50% to 44%. Meanwhile, a Fox News poll gives Hillary Clinton a 4-point lead in the four-way race. She leads Donald Trump 48 to 44% nationwide.
And we know how that turned out.
Donald Trump, we project, will win in Kentucky with its 8 electoral votes, in Indiana with its 11 electoral votes, West Virginia, Tennessee, Mississippi, South Carolina, Alabama, Kansas, Florida.
There's plenty that's different about this year's race compared to 2016, but many people are understandably more wary of polling results this time around. But what if I told you that at least one pollster got it right back in 2016?
She's using more data than pretty much anyone here could understand in a lifetime.
No idea how many people this week have come up to me and said, what's Polly saying? What's Polly saying?
She can see patterns in people that we can't see ourselves.
Meet Polly, an artificially intelligent pollster. Polly was developed by a market research company in Ottawa. And the company says she didn't just correctly predict the 2016 election result, she also called the federal vote that handed the Liberals a minority last year. Oh, and the Brexit Leave vote? Polly nailed that too. Peter Gombos is the director of Margin of Error, a new documentary about Polly and the ways machine learning could transform political polling. Peter, good morning. Welcome to Day 6.
Hi, Brent. Good morning.
Peter, in 2016, what was Polly doing that was different from traditional, human pollsters?
Well, as opposed to human pollsters who were making phone calls and conducting surveys online with assorted voters, Polly was scouring Twitter data to find out, without asking those individuals, what their likely vote was going to be.
So Polly doesn't ask questions, which is the bread and butter of traditional pollsters. But cutting through the vast noise of Twitter to actually find information that's helpful must be a very difficult task.
That's right. But you have to appreciate that when they're talking about Twitter data being analyzed, they're not talking about the first level of data, the sort of what's known as the fire hose of Twitter data.
Right, right. And anyone who spends time on Twitter can tell you that it skews all over the place. It could be young, urban, it could be opinionated, it could be bots. So how does this technology find a data set that actually makes sense, that's comparable to the same data set that pollsters work in bringing you when they ask their questions?
Well, according to Kenton White, who's the lead scientist behind this AI, the most important trick is the same thing that pollsters do. Polly builds a representative sample on Twitter. Mm-hmm. So she scours through the publicly available data and users and correlates those users with the Canadian census so that it builds a representative sample for each of the 338 ridings across Canada that matches the demographics according to the census.
And then once that model is built, what is the information that Polly extracts from it?
Well, that means Polly can look back through at least 5 years of behavior patterns of those users, assuming they've been on Twitter that long.
Right.
And it can establish a connection between voter behaviors on Twitter and voter outcomes from a known result, and then see how patterns of Twitter behavior is happening in the present, and then predict voter outcomes.
That's fascinating. And not one of these users was called by a pollster. Not one of them had to pick up the phone and answer questions. But it immediately raises privacy concerns, doesn't it? I mean, is that something that you've thought about when you've been researching
100%. Of course, you can't work on this kind of doc without thinking of Cambridge Analytica and the way it was using piggybacking on Facebook to micro-target users and push skewed information towards people based on psychological profiles. The argument from Polly's handlers is they're actually doing something best described as the opposite of Cambridge Analytica. Rather than micro-targeting individuals, they do not share the list of users in their representative sample, number one. And secondly, they use a variety of anonymization tools to hide the identity of those users. So it's a double blind situation like they do in the medical industry. Mm-hmm. The people in the sample don't realize they've been analyzed, mm-hmm. and the people who are conducting the sample, they don't know who's in it in the list as well.
But what does that mean if governments or other regulators start to crack down on this sort of data collection? Would Polly's ability to collect data be impaired? And does that end this kind of model of prediction?
That's an excellent question, Brent. It really depends on how we understand what regulations of social media we're talking about. I mean, right now, Polly is using public data from Twitter that anybody could use. It's mm-hmm. not like it's a special insider information from Twitter. It's not the same data that the social media platform itself has.
Right.
So in effect, that insider information, that inside list of behaviors is what the Cambridge Analytica scandal was talking about. Is they had information that only Facebook had.
But with polling as important to modern politics as it is now, and when we look ahead to the American election coming up in just under 3 weeks, there's this risk of a contested election. That the data, the ability to predict, is arguably more important than ever. If AI programs like Pauly can improve the accuracy of these, improve the use of data, do you think it's worth the privacy risks?
I don't know. That's a scary question. It depends on whether we need to regulate the predictors as well as the social media platforms.
Do you think that Pauly's creators are worried about that?
I think Pauly's creators believe at this point that there is such a demand for people to be able to share information publicly, freely on social media, that there isn't, in the short term, a likely restriction on access to data. But I still think it's a very important question to ask. And if information is restricted, or if end users are allowed to demand transparency of how their information is used on social media platforms, that could change not only the way they behave on social media mm-hmm. platforms, but mm-hmm. the quality of the data that a third party could access.
You show us skeptics in your film, skeptics of AI technology displacing pollsters, but many of them are pollsters themselves. What do you think? Do you think this is the future?
Well, I think pollsters are in a really tough spot. I think their job is proving harder and harder to do based on the way our society is fragmented by technology. Mm-hmm. We're on more social media platforms, we're mobile and so on. So I think to find public opinion, you have to go where the new public sphere is, and that's defined by technology. You have to look on social media. Whether that's going to be a problem or not is a bit of an open debate.
Will you be watching Pauly's predictions as November 3rd in the American election nears?
Oh, absolutely. You can actually see the current prediction on their website. I'm wondering if it's going to be a Biden landslide, as she claims, currently.
Peter Gombos, thank you for being with us.
All right. Thank you very much, Brent.
Peter Gombos is the director of Margin of Error. It premieres in Ontario tonight on TVO.
Welcome home, Mr. President.
Thank you. What I miss.
Okay, so it's last January. Feels like a lifetime ago, then a world where The West Wing was on the air. I can't even. The West Wing ran from 1999 to 2006. It was created by Aaron Sorkin, and it portrayed the administration of President Josiah Jed Bartlet. It was lauded and pilloried as an idealized version of what a liberal Democratic presidency could have been if it hadn't been run by, you know, Bill Clinton. Earlier this year, most of the original cast staged a live performance of an episode from season 3, and that performance dropped this week on HBO Max.
So this West Wing special is a PSA for When We All Vote, which is a nonprofit, nonpartisan group that encourages voting access in America. The cast is reunited, but they are not doing anything new, no new material. They're doing Hartsfield's Landing, which is a season 3 episode.
Sonia Saraya is a television critic for Vanity Fair. We asked her to tell us about this week's West Wing reunion and how the show holds up three administrations after it began.
When I first heard that they were going to come back together for an episode, I was a little cynical, I have to be honest. There have been a lot of cast reunions during the pandemic. 30 Rock did one and Parks and Recreation did one. It's great when Hollywood people get together for a good cause and stuff, but sometimes the nostalgia or the kind of fan service element of it overtakes making it something that people really want to watch. And I think in the specific case of the West Wing with the election, the West Wing has such an interesting role in the American imagination. There are some people who really revile the show, even as it does have its very loyal fans. And partly that's because it presents this idea of American politics that is so idealistic and earnest and very much wearing rose-colored glasses. And I think for some people that's kind of a bomb, and then for other people that's very frustrating.
You're the president. You don't have to act like it. You're a good man. You don't have to act like it. You're not just folks. You're not plain spoken. Do not act like it.
But when I started watching it, it was really great to see the cast kind of snap back into their roles. One thing that's really marvelous about the cast is that they work together so beautifully, and they're so committed to their characters, and they really seem to enjoy the banter that the writer and creator Aaron Sorkin gives them to do. I have to say, the special is produced really beautifully. There's some really cool staging and direction, just with using the stage, using a live stage setup, and they manage to make it a very evocative space.
A small press corps waits behind a rope line, and the plane's main cabin door opens. Bartlett emerges. Andrews Air Force Base, 8:40 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Welcome home, Mr. President. Welcome back, Mr. President.
How was your trip?
You know, the episode is 20 years old, or almost 20 years old. So the contrast between just imagining the way that the occupants of the White House currently talk about foreign policy and how Bartlett and his staff talks about foreign policy, and even the fact that Bartlett's sitting down to play chess and comes to it with this very sophisticated, big brain, far-reaching perspective about this volatile situation. It's just, it feels so removed from reality. I sort of felt the same excitement for the show that I have felt in the past. And also, I think, with the experience of the last 20 years in politics, feel that the show is such a fantasy and feel that that is sad.
Now, get on the phone, find out what the problem with the president is, and solve it.
All right, except for I can't get on this phone.
Why?
It's a government phone. I can't use it to intimidate voters.
Sad, but true. You know what I'm thinking?
People who grew up on the West Wing, and I'm including myself, maybe came into the world with a very unrealistic idea of how ruthless and brutal American politics can be. It's tricky because I know that there are a lot of people who would maybe prefer for politics to be like the way they are in the West Wing, where people are really negotiating in good faith and come from a very strong sense of public service in everything that they do. And, you know, Sorkin wrote The West Wing coming out of the Clinton impeachment scandal as a kind of alternate Democrat president that fulfilled more of his vision of what he wanted out of the West Wing.
Our battle carrier groups are in international waters. Are you claiming jurisdiction?
No.
Then let's settle down.
There's this disconnect between how truly educational the West Wing is. But at the same time, it may have built an expectation that people in politics operate in good faith or with the best intentions, but it doesn't quite prepare you for what politics can be. Speaking as an American right now, it's been a very dispiriting time to see that a lot of politicians don't act in good faith, and it feels a little frustrating to have been sold a myth of, or an illusion of, American democracy that just isn't grounded in reality.
Sonia Saraya is a television critic for Vanity Fair. Still, lots to come here on day 6, including the salad days are over for iceberg lettuce, or are they?
Greens for the win, and iceberg is one of my favorites.
You're tuned in to KWMR Point Reyes Station, West Marin Community Radio.
I'm Brent Bambury. You're listening to Day 6 on CBC Radio 1. We are on PRX. Live stream us on the CBC Listen app, and we're online at cbc.ca/day6. There's a new number one single on the Hot 100 this week. K-pop sensation BTS has been displaced by BTS. If I woke up without you, I don't know what I would do. Okay, Savage Love is mostly Jason Derulo and Josh 685. But even so, it's the first time a Korean band has ever had the number one and number two songs at the same time. And it's the first time anyone has done that in a little more than a decade. And in case you've forgotten what the number two song is... You're welcome. So this turned out to be a good week for Big Hit Entertainment to launch a stock offering. Big Hit Entertainment is the company that manages BTS. On Thursday, it offered up shares worth about 20% of the company, and the value of those shares nearly doubled on the first day of trading, bringing the company's valuation to just under $10 billion Canadian. That's a huge bet on a company that gets more than 80% of its revenue from a boy band that, I'm sorry to say, can't stay young forever. But there's one thing Big Hit Entertainment has going for it that's even bigger than BTS, and that's the BTS Army. Cedar Bioseji is a scholar of contemporary Korean culture and a deeply devoted K-pop fan. Cedar Bao, good morning. Welcome back to Day 6.
Good morning, Brent.
It's not just investors. Fans all over the world are clamoring for shares in Big Hit now. That's a lot more dedication than just buying a concert t-shirt. But what does it tell us about the BTS Army?
Well, back in 2008, the fans of the group Super Junior actually bought into SM Entertainment, and it gave them a seat at the table. Hmm. Like, they only were able to amass less than 0.5% of shares of the company, mm-hmm. but through that, they were able to have their voice heard. So now, with fans buying into Big Hit, it's so much more meaningful to them than just owning an album. They actually have a seat at the table. They actually have a way to express their ideas about how Big Hit should be run going forward.
It's a fascinating dynamic. And of course, we don't know at this point what percentage of total ownership the fans have. But I'm just curious, if you could get your hands on the stock, would you buy in as either a fan or investor?
If it wasn't such a hassle to buy stocks in Korea as somebody who's currently located outside of Korea, I probably would have bought one or two just for the symbolic value. But I'm not really an investor type.
Right. Okay, well, that's fair. But it was a big week for a Big Hit. Do you think that they knew BTS would have the top two songs on the Billboard Hot 100 the week that they decided to launch the IPO?
I don't think anybody could have predicted that. Savage Love in particular was kind of a surprise that people responded so well to that cover. But I certainly think that sort of flex and the fact that that was achieved through the hard work of ARMY supporting the members of BTS, I think that flex really demonstrated what sort of promise there is going forward.
Share prices doubled in the first day of trading, and the company's value hit about $8 billion U.S. Besides the members of BTS, who else got rich this week?
Well, Bang Si-hyuk, obviously, is the person who profited the most. And by all accounts, he really deserves the credit, and he deserves the payout. He had this vision, and he made it happen with BTS. And the really beautiful thing with him sharing so much of the stock shares with the members of BTS, it demonstrates how he understands BTS's position within the company as the group that made this vision of his come to life.
But the cliche in the music business, especially when you talk about a manufactured group or a boy band or a girl band, is that management exploits the artists. And it looks like an incredibly magnanimous move on the part of Bang Si-hyuk to share this incredible windfall this week. But is there any evidence that the relationship between management and artists in this case has evolved beyond that cliche of exploitation?
There's no evidence that the members of BTS have ever felt exploited by Bang Si-hyuk. They seem to have a very close and even comfortable relationship with him, where they, you know, refer to him in their songs. And so he clearly understands that it is the hard work of BTS that has allowed his company to do so well. And so they are under contract with him until 2024. But the best way to ensure that they continue to be part of Big Hit is to have them directly connected to the success of the company. And those stock shares basically mean that if they leave Big Hit in 2024, that they are sacrificing some of their own potential investment in the company.
Right, right. So, but if they did leave in 2024, is there, I mean, would Big Hit still be an $8 billion company? Or would they still be as nearly valuable as they are now that BTS is still with them?
Well, you know, I was thinking about this and I found out that in 2019, George Harrison, who has been dead for some time now, earned $9 million estimated. That's the thing, is even if BTS is in the military or even if they leave Big Hit, the catalog of products that they've already created together with Big Hit Entertainment will stay with Big Hit Entertainment.
Right.
So Big Hit will continue to be able to sell copies of albums that came out in 2013 or 2016 for the rest of time.
There is an argument out there that investors who are buying up stock in Big Hit are actually more interested in having access to the BTS army than to Big Hit, BTS, or any of the other products. What is the value of the BTS army, do you think, from an investor's perspective? What makes it so remarkable?
Well, the members of the BTS army are going to support BTS. Whatever the product is, they're going to buy it, they're going to download it, they're going to strategically get that song to the top of the charts, they're going to spread it around the world. That level of love for the group has been demonstrated so well that I think many investors felt as long as this kind of army exists, this kind of investment is going to pay off.
Cedarbaugh, do you think that there are risks in this incredible valuation of this entertainment asset?
Well, there are always risks if you are depending on humans, right? Humans can get in a car accident. Humans can get caught up in a scandal. We really can't predict the future. And seven individuals now have become incredibly precious, not just for their musical output, but for the huge amount of money that people have invested in them.
Right. What you mentioned just a few minutes ago, that at some point in the next couple of years, all of the members of BTS are supposed to fulfill their mandatory military service. What do you think is going to happen? Do you think the Korean government will actually just put these boys in the army?
It's a very difficult issue, partially because in Korean culture, being an adult man includes having served your country in this way.
Right.
All of the members of BTS have their own feelings about going to the military and serving their country. So this is not just an issue where the government gets to decide, give them an exemption. Do the members of BTS strongly feel that they should do what other young Korean men have to do?
Well, they'll be the richest soldiers in that army after this week. Cedarbaugh Saeji, thank you very much for talking to us.
All right, thank you.
Switch me, bring the fire, set the night alight.
Iceberg, light ahead!
Thank you.
Oh, the tragedy of icebergs. Not the Titanic kind, but the leafy green vegetable kind.
I absolutely love iceberg lettuce.
That's Chris Kendall. He's a registered holistic nutritionist and raw food chef in Saskatoon. His blog is rawadvantage.com. But unfortunately for Chris and iceberg lettuce lovers everywhere, you don't have as much company as you used to. This week, Bloomberg published a story with the headline, America has lost its taste for iceberg lettuce. It predicts that this will be the year that romaine, kale, and Boston, the trendier, hipper greens, surpass the sales of iceberg. But Chris says he's not letting the iceberg go down without a fight.
You know, I'm definitely want to put out a good defense for it because I think that it's a misunderstood and underappreciated green.
Do we really misunderstand lettuce? So, a common complaint you might hear about iceberg is that it's just made of water. So, what's the point?
Calorie per calorie, greens are the most nutrient-dense foods on the planet. Iceberg lettuce is a perfect example of low-calorie, high-fiber, so it actually makes you full, but it's also chock-full of nutrition. You know, so it's only slightly lower in the nutritional scale if we're comparing it to other greens, which, again, are the highest nutrient density of any food on the planet. You compare it to almost any other food, and it's still incredibly nutrient-dense.
Huh. And Chris says there's another reason to stick with iceberg.
It may not be quite as nutritious as some of the other greens, but enjoyment really does come into play. It's really hydrating. And most people, they say they enjoy iceberg lettuce a ton. It's just they get tricked and fooled into the thought that they need more nutrition every single bite, when on the other side, they're actually usually eating foods that are no calorie and no nutrition or anti-nutrition. So it just makes sense to enjoy more of the foods you absolutely love. And iceberg fits perfectly in there as a food that most people love and digest great and has high water content while being highly nutritious.
Now compare that to kale. Seriously, wouldn't you rather it be you getting a massage instead of your vegetable?
I would definitely rather have a massage 10 times out of 10.
And let's be honest, romaine and kale may be trendy, but what's a Taco Tuesday without shredded iceberg lettuce?
You know, I love eating iceberg lettuce in many different ways. I'd say probably the most common, and I do this for most of my greens, to be honest, is to slice it in half and then cut it really finely. So it's almost like shreds or like noodles. I like salads, but I like it really in noodles way more than big leafy chunks. So I do that, and I just put any salad dressing or sauce on top of it to make a ton of different types as a raw food chef. Or otherwise, just use it as like a wrap. So take them off leaf per leaf, and then put some salsa, some guacamole, maybe some mushrooms and tomatoes and some spices, and make a nice burrito out of those leaves.
And that's just the tip of the iceberg. I know. But try making that joke with arugula. Anyway, Chris says there are even more uses for iceberg lettuce that you've probably not even thought about.
You know, a lot of people talk about green smoothies. Well, iceberg lettuce actually makes an incredibly great green smoothie because it's high water content. The fiber is really soft, so it blends up really, really well and is a really mild tasting green, so it doesn't overpower your smoothie. So people who want to get into green smoothies but maybe you're a little afraid of kale, iceberg lettuce makes a great option.
Okay, fine, but didn't director John Waters once describe iceberg lettuce as the polyester of the vegetable kingdom?
Well, you know, I don't know where John's coming from, because actually I really enjoy polyester at times. Right now I'm wearing a polyester sweater that I absolutely love, and all of my underwear now are polyester kind of compression underwear, and I absolutely love them. So, I mean, if he's comparing it that way, I really also love iceberg lettuce.
Right. John Waters made a movie called Polyester, so he probably agrees with Chris, but point taken. Anyway, if iceberg lettuce isn't on your shopping list, Chris says, time to turn over a new leaf.
The more you love your food, the better it works with your system, and the more likely you're going to eat enough of it to sustain yourself and not be craving a bunch of other junk food. So greens for the win, and iceberg is one of my favorites.
Nutritionist and raw food chef Chris Kendall scores one for the iceberg in Saskatoon. And that's our show for this week. Day 6 was produced by Lori Allen, Annie Bender, Samir Chabra, and Pedro Sanchez. Our digital producer is Jason Vermesh. Our senior producer is Gord Westmacott. And I'm Brent Bambry. It's 7 days to the BC election, 3 days to Game 1 of the World Series, and 7 days till we meet again on Day 6.
Me like aina toinele pasti nisi toinele to proyo mauka momi pasti nisi toinele nisi tori toinele to proyo mauka momi emgi me la doinele emble da.
Deserve.